Blog Talk Radio.
There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and tell you why. We will feed them on the land, on the sea, and in the sky. There's a better world to come and tell you why. There's a better world to come and don't you see? When we'll all be union and we'll all be free. There's a better world to come and don't you see?
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host and news director, Rick Spezak, welcoming you once again to Progressive News Network, the place where progressives can hear the voices of other activists across the state and beyond doing the good work that will, in fact, build a better world. Lots of news tonight, so let me get right to it. Number one, if you missed the Ledger Camp this past weekend, you missed a great experience. Progressives from across the state came together to look at the strategies we're all going to use to get rid of Rick Scott and to rebuild the Florida political scene. It was fantastic. People who worked on so many issues were there. There were working groups that came together. People pitched good, important ideas. You'll be able to go to the Democratic Progressive Caucus website and Facebook site to see that information. It's going to be posted up there this week. Make sure if you don't get a chance to go this year, make sure you go next year. And there's some big news coming up very, very soon about another important action. And I just hope you're all awake for it, if you know what I mean. News at that to come. Listen, contact your legislators to get moving on the ERA bills, SB 54 and HCR 8001 out of committee, and get them to vote. Legislators, it's time to show your courage and lead the way for America. Now's your time, progressives. Get out there. Give these people a call. Let them know that you're there. Let them know there are progressives in this community. The Tea Party is not the only one who knows how to dial a phone. You get out there. You let your legislatures know that you want this done. Legislators, it's time to show your courage, lead the way for America, and move on the ERA bills SB 54 and HCR 8001. Get them out of committee and get ready to vote. Okay, there's another announcement we have to make. Please join the special End the War and Occupation call. It's Tuesday, February 12th. 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 8 p.m. Central Time, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, and 6 p.m. Pacific Time. They're proud to welcome Father Ray Bourgeois as our guest speaker for this month's call. This is a PDA event. If you need more information on PDA, look them up, brothers and sisters, look them up. While working as a Mary Knoll priest in Latin America, Father Roy witnessed at firsthand the deadly results of U.S. programs to train Latin American military officers to suppress popular indigenous movements in their countries. In 1990, he founded SOA Watch to campaign for the end of these programs and the closure of the School of Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia, where most of the U.S. Training takes place. For 23 years, SOA Watch, School of the Americas Watch, has held annual vigils attended by tens of thousands outside the gates of Fort Benning. More recently, Father Roy has led SOA Watch delegations to meet with governments in Latin America that have persuaded six countries to withdraw their officers from SOA training. SOA Watch is inviting activists from across the U.S. to join them on delegations to El Salvador, Paraguay, and Chile in 2013. And Father Roy will talk about these trips in the call. The date and time, Tuesday, February 12th, 9 p.m. Eastern Time, 8 p.m. Central Time, 7 p.m. Mountain Time, 6 p.m. Pacific Time. And get that phone number from PDA. Okay? Take action. President Obama's selection for director of the CIA, John Brennan, will come before the U.S. Senate for confirmation vote very soon. Please tell your senators to vote no on the confirmation of John Brennan as CIA director. His policies have demonstrated an unacceptable lack of respect for international law, human rights, and basic values. PDA joins with human rights, peace, civic liberties, and other organizations strongly opposing the appointment. Use the action alert. Captive audience. There's a new book by Susan Crawford, who's at the Benjamin Cardoza School of Law. It's about internet access and how we get to pay more and get less speed than basically any other place in the world. It's about the lack of competition and the lack of regulation and oversight. Look it up. It's an incredible read. It was just on the Bill Moyer show. You can probably catch the Bill Moyer's piece online. Check it out. If you actually use the internet, this is important to you. Okay, as we continue, read, act, discuss. Mass incarceration continues Sunday, February 10th and 24th, 1 p.m. in Oakland Park in Fort Lauderdale. General public is invited and urged to address the issues poised by Michelle Alexander in her book, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. Join 20 people from diverse environments, few of whom knew more than a few of the others, who had a stimulating initial January 6th meeting and resolved to meet five more times over the next 3 months to discuss Alexander's analysis of the rebirth of the U.S. caste system, whose population consists primarily of African-American men whose lives have been constrained by their contacts and their criminal justice system, who therefore face a lifelong discrimination in housing, employment, and civic participation. Alexander graphically depicts how the criminal justice system, based on a hyperinflated war on drugs, functions as a means of social control of these populations, following dismantling of Jim Crow in the 1960s. Alexander challenges the civil rights community and all of us to place mass incarceration at the forefront of a new movement for racial justice in America. Next, the gift that keeps on giving. The Department of Energy is about to approve the release of radioactive metal into the general raw and reusable metal market. U.S. Department of Energy Secretary Stephen Chu plans to dump 14,000 tons of radioactive scrap metal into the marketplace for use in the manufacturing of consumer products. Hey, isn't that great? This means your everyday purchases such as silverware, zippers, belt buckles, eyeglass frames, jewelry, watches, toys, pet bowls, leashes could soon be made with radioactive scrap metal. Hey, the gift that keeps on giving. This action is being fast-tracked with little regard for public comment. The deadline for decision is Monday, February 11th. Hey, that's not till tomorrow. That's why there was an emergency petition created on signon.org. Go to signon.org and look for it. Directly to the Secretary of Energy, Stephen Chu, which says stop the Department of Energy's plans to use 14,000 tons of radioactive scrap metal in the manufacturing of consumer products. There is no safe level of radiation. Keep nuclear waste out of my home, out of my workplace, and out of my clothes. Evidence? Evidence? Somebody asked about evidence? Senator Ron Wyden, let me ask you several other questions with regard to the president's authority to kill Americans. I've been asking you how much evidence the president needs to decide that a particular American can be lawfully killed and whether the administration believes that the president can use this authority inside the United States. In my judgment, both the Congress and the public need to understand the answers to these kind of fundamental questions. What do you think needs to be done to ensure the members of the public understand more about when the government thinks it's allowed to kill them, particularly with respect to those two issues, the question of evidence and the authority to use that power within the United States? And John Brennan says, I have been a strong proponent of trying to be as open as possible with these programs as far as explaining what we're doing. What we need is to do optimize transparency on these issues, but at the same time optimize secrecy and the protection of our national security. As clear an answer as you'd ever find in the bottom of, oh, I don't know, a polluted lake. I don't think that that's one or the other. I think I've been trying to optimize both of them. And so what we need to do is to make sure we explain to the American people that we are on the threshold of action. What are the procedures, the practices, the processes, the approvals, the reviews, the Office of Legal Counsel advice establishes the legal boundaries within which we may operate. It doesn't mean that we can operate at those boundaries. And in fact, I think that the authorities' and these capabilities are a last resort. Hey, oh, that's a lot of information there, right? Okay, and guess what? In today's Stewart News, that firebrand of American authority, there's a new voter purge list mailed. You know, you think you those Republicans out there got the message. Yeah, well, more of the same tricks. So make sure you're not listed on that new voter purge list sent out by the Secretary of State of Florida, because guess what? Purge and purge again. On Monday, NBC leaked a Justice Department white paper laying out the Obama administration's case for when the president or any any or any informed high-level official of the federal government can authorize the secret killing of a U.S. citizen without charges, hearing, or a trial. You know, I think you should add that to your reading list. Of course, only if you're interested in, you know, having some rights left. And speaking of rights, we've got a wonderful show tonight. We've got Alan Hendricks coming up next, a candidate for Boynton City Commission. We've got Jay Alexander, whose work on reviving the Civilian Conservation Corps will provide some interesting news. Also, we've got Reverend Gary Wilson, who's talking about an event next week called Healing Our Planet and Ourselves. And then to wrap it up, we've got a professor from the U.S. Naval College, and her name is Professor Summer Gentry. She'll be talking about her work to rein in the TSA. So we've got a great show lined up for you tonight. And while we're waiting for the good candidate, Mr. Hendricks, to show up, we will continue the news. Interesting stuff going on. Okay. NDAA advocates, linguist and political activist Noam Chomsky, Pentagon Papers whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, journalist Alexa O'Brien, Revolution Truth, executive director Tangerine Bolin, along with activist Brigitte Johnsdottir and Kai Guargala, are co-plaintiffs represented by attorneys Carl Mayer and Bruce Affron. Supporters dubbed the seven plaintiffs, including Hedges, the Magnificent Seven. Well, ladies and gentlemen, we're on to our first guest. And on behalf of my co-producer, Mickey Royce, and I want to welcome the charming and talented, the handsome, the skilled, the politically savvy, Mr. Alan Hendricks. Alan, come on in.
Hi, Rick. How are you?
Pretty good, buddy, but not as politically savvy as you, my friend. Tell us, how's that candidacy going?
Oh, man, what an interesting journey we are on.
You know, of all the things that you've imagined would be happening when you were a candidate, what surprised you the most?
What surprised me the most? Honestly, the what surprised me the most is the not what I would call above the board politics that goes on behind the scenes.
Sure.
Not that that surprises me, but you know, it's just kind of confirmed some of the worst fears. It hasn't reared its ugly head in the public, but the, you know, behind the scenes machine is just working.
Well, that's probably why you're involved in politics, because you're a man who's been working in development in the work of urban renewal for a long time as a professional. Let me ask you first to talk a little bit about yourself. What made you motivated, sir, to participate in government? You know, not to be just an observer, another passing consumer. What was it in your life that brought you to the point where you said, you know, you had to contribute?
You know, I've been asked that, and it sounds very hokey, the answer, but it's the real answer is, there's nothing more rewarding than being able to come to your city, whether it was, you know, where I grew up in West Palm Beach or Boynton Beach or wherever you happen to be, and affect some good positive change on a societal level, you know, to bring your talents to bear for the good of your fellow man, you know, if you will. So getting into it was just kind of an extension of my activism. This is related to my professional career, you know, urban renewal and making safe neighborhoods and making great places for people to, you know, live, work, play, is incredibly rewarding, you know. So it's a natural fit for me. It's something that I'm talented at, and I just want to, you know, bring it to bear on the people around me. So that's how it really came to be.
That's great. You know, when you look at, you know, a variety of different urban locations, I know there are different neighborhoods in Boynton Beach, and each one has its own unique strengths and weaknesses, and you bring a professional eye to this. If you were to kind of prioritize the, you know, urban renewal and the urban improvements you'd like to see happening, what are some of the areas you'd like to see worked on, and what kind of changes would you like to see develop in your fair city?
Well, I've kind of divided into two sections. There is the neighborhood section, which is Chapel Hill and Forest Park and some of the more typical residential kind of neighborhoods. And they are good neighborhoods, but they need love and attention. You know, whether it's cleaning up a streetscape or going in there and actually doing some, you know, getting rid of some of these foreclosures, because there's a kind of a patchwork of nice homes, and every once in a while you'll find a home that really doesn't look like it fits the neighborhood, and that's kind of a problem that we're going to have to address, and that really is on the neighborhood scale. So you have to kind of take my activism talents and put it to work there on, you know, organizing neighborhoods, and government can lend assistance to make that help to, you know, happen, but it's really going to be up to the residents. The other side of it is the federal corridor, where we're going to be doing a lot of big development, basically. There's a lot of empty land out there that needs to be developed, and if we are sensitive to how we put that together, to where we make good connections, pedestrian connections, and we connect the residential side with the small business side, and, you know, have the traffic patterns going, all this other kind of good stuff, you know, how high do we go, we can create a great, great product. And if we don't get our hands wrapped around it, we're going to end up with a less than great product. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, one of the things I think is interesting is that since you're a professional whose life work before you were working in politics was literally looking at urban spaces and making life quality of life improvements. And I think that's so good, because I was in Florida City after Hurricane Andrew, for example, and a team of architects come down from Central Florida and said, oh, you could do this and you could do that, with no idea at all of the economic base, the kind of lifestyle people had. And, you know, you just can't place a celebration in the middle of Florida City agricultural community. That's just not going to work.
Right. No, you have to be sensitive to place and know the culture of the place. And, you know, there's a whole lot that goes into it. And I look at it and, you know, at times I go, you know, this is not rocket science, but I forget that I went to school for 5 years and I've been practicing for 10 years, you know, so it's not rocket science to me, because I'm dialed in, you know.
Sure.
I see things through those eyes, you know.
Well, you know what the real costs of things are, and that gives you, I think, a real leg up in the situation.
Yes, and working with developers and you know, besides the design part of it, you know, how do you actually make all that come together? I've just seen some places where we're falling short, and it's kind of the mode of operation that we have been working under, and I see tweaks to that. You know, we need to, you know, work with developers, but not give away the farm. You know, we need to negotiate and make it work for everybody, you know, so everybody walks away just a little bit unhappy. and that's not going to happen if we don't get in there and do it. I'm a little bit concerned that we don't have our design guidelines down. We don't have a strong enough architectural review. I would like to have somebody. I think every commission should have somebody who understands planning and landscape architecture and those kind of disciplines on their dais. I think it would be a benefit to any city.
Absolutely. Obviously, a lot of Florida's never had that benefit.
Yeah. Well, we've learned a lot, and there's extraordinary examples across the nation where cities have gone in and redeveloped and made things great. You know, I keep saying walkable communities, but and people like walkable communities. You know, you get people on the street, they're well-lit streets, they're, you know, safe. You start to build community that way, and you know, a community, I talk about community, and it's not just some kind of feel-good thing. You know, it builds in property values and safety and enjoyment for the people who live there. You know, so it just seems to me, you know, from my vantage point, that this is something that the southeast and the eastern side of Boynton Beach really, really needs.
Let me ask you this. I understand that you're looking at analyzing the budget priorities that currently exist and then how those too might be tweaked to serve the public mm-hmm. better.
Yeah. Well, we've all been through, you know, the recession didn't help our efforts, and we've been through a whole lot of trimming down of our budget. And we still, you know, the government functions at one level and private business functions at another level. We need to, you know, use our dollars wisely. And I just really think that almost across the board in every budget line item we look at, that we could save some money, and those little pieces of money add up to big pieces of money. You know, when you're dealing with I deal with budgets, you know, $150 million budgets for a project, and I've seen how we continually keep an eye on every line item to keep things in budget. Otherwise, you've blown your budget, and, you know, things are very bad when it happens. And if we don't have money for, you know, some streetscape improvements and infrastructure improvements, you know, to make our neighborhoods better, we've got our budget priorities wrong.
I understand, you know, that a lot of civil government these days is looking for public-private partnerships. Do you see anything that you might see as helpful to the community in that regard?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'm not sure what scale that is going to be on, but that's an option that we should, you know, keep open and on the table. I think what we're going to, you know, and I kind of see it in some of the smaller projects. We've got two large parcels down here that are going to get developed, and their zoning is pretty doggone dense. But in some of the smaller parcels, like we have an elder kind of a civic center, you know, some of those can be public private, and, you know, can work out for the city, and it can work out for private business. You know, there's opportunities indeed, and the reason these have come to be is because out of necessity we've kind of needed to get creative to provide services, or, you know, bring opportunities to our city, where the city can't do the whole thing, but they can be a partner in it, if that makes sense to you.
A lot of times communities adopt a penny rich, pound foolish, and seem to turn away from the arts, which can be such a money raiser and community builder. Well, how do you feel about that? Do you think there's a place for the arts in today's contemporary city?
I think there almost has to be. I got some feedback on this the other day, and you know, people just they may not understand the importance of the arts, but you know, to create kind of a beautiful place for people to be, the arts has to be in it. You know, that's just part of the mix. That's part of a healthy mix in a healthy city. You know, is how are your parks and recreation? You know, arts. How's your infrastructure? How's your entertainment? How's your education? You know, what kind of support do you give to neighborhoods? And, you know, arts is part of that mix. I can't really imagine it not being part of the mix.
Well, you know, you can't talk about city government very long before you say, you know, what are we going to do to raise some money? And, of course, there's a lot of resistance to taxing. But I understand you have some innovative ideas, air rights for future development. What kind of ideas do you have in that arena of developing more funds and more revenue for the city?
Right. Well, there's lots of good examples of how cities have kind of got creative in raising their revenue or keeping a handle on their expenditures. The air rights was actually, It was actually a development idea. The two large parcels I talked to you about are zoned for really high density. And what we'd like to do is be able to spread that around a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I'll negotiate with the developers and, you know, make it a win-win for the city and for the developers. But the people in Boynton Beach are really going to they're going to resist, you know, another couple 15-story towers. And the way you want to build your city is to kind of step down these taller towers, which are good for building, you know, density in, but to spread that to where it blends back into the residential part of your city, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
The air rights come into play. And we, as a city, really haven't been paying much attention to that, and it's a tool that we should be using.
Okay. When you look at the zoning issues facing the city right now, where do you see room for change or room for improvement? Can you tick off one or two areas, or is that too specific?
No, not at all. I think now this goes back to the federal corridor. We need to look at, you know, we need a kind of a master plan to look at it and say, you know, this is the best possible way we can develop this area. What you don't want is, you know, just a wall of high-density, low-rise residential along Federal without any services. What you need to do is put some mixed use in there so the residential density supports local businesses, and it makes it a better place for, you know, people to live. They can walk over and get their dry cleaning or walk over and get a sandwich. And if we don't take a good grasp of that and kind of have the vision and work from there, we're going to end up with, you know, a lot of residential and kind of spotty. You need to kind of plan these things out, where things happen, where people gather, where nodes are, you know, traffic nodes and pedestrian nodes. So we have the power, and, you know, to shape the city we want to have. And I just don't feel like we've got a good handle on that right now. And that'll take working with planning and zoning and to create maybe an overlay system to encourage building that city that we want. Is that making sense to you? I keep asking
sure.
you that question.
Ure. Let me
sure.
ask you this.
I babble on about stuff, and I'm like, well, am I even speaking the same language sometimes?
Sure. I was wondering if you can talk about, you know, it's a kind of mixed blessing when you have public input. Do you see any need for improvements in how the public relates to the city commission? You know, sometimes some cities get a little concerned that there's, you know, almost too much public input. How would you say the balance is right now for the city commission as you see it now? And do you see any changes in that arena?
Well, I see this. I see that we, for whatever reason, I haven't quite figured out why we don't do a good job of communicating from the city government side to the residents. Even with events, even things we'd like to celebrate, we just don't do a great job of getting the word out. There's kind of a lack of community, and we can certainly improve that. I think that public input is good. I've been walking neighborhoods, and I haven't heard anything that surprised me. But it's reinforced everything that I kind of thought I understood, you know, about what people's concerns were, you know, what their hopes and aspirations were for the city. And I just think that dialogue has to be, you know, it might make things a little bit messy, you know, but at the end of the day, it makes for a better product. And it, so I welcome that. You know, I would like for us to tone down the negativity and start, you know, working on solutions. And that's kind of relationship building. So that's a communication thing as well.
I heard about a very innovative plan the other day from an activist who was working in St. Petersburg, Florida, in the Pinellas County area. And one of the things that they did was they really opened up the budgeting process to the public, inviting a lot of stakeholders, you know, across the community, from religious groups to environmental quality of life groups to education groups. And they invited the public to really participate in developing budgeting priorities. And I was struck by how innovative that was. And I know you're such a progressive person. You're so motivated to keep the public voice in the public business. I would urge you to look at that situation as something you might use as a model, because the public input and informed, aware, alert public is going to be a happier, it's going to make for a happier city.
Absolutely. Yeah, the budget process is not something everybody wants to sit in on.
Oh, absolutely. There are more boring things, but not many.
Well, you know, yeah, it's incredibly important. It's but it's kind of certainly not all that entertaining. However, you're right that you know, the more you kind of open things up, you just never know where great ideas are going to come from. You know, the getting people involved in the budget process is probably going to be the challenge, but you know, then they start to understand how their government works, and they can be a watchdog. You know, because we, in my view, we could be doing better to, you know, be good stewards of residents. I'm not you know, casting blame or anything, but I think just kind of as a the mode of operation we're under, we need to be more careful with our money. And if people would get involved, yeah, they could bring us some creative ideas, and they could also keep an eye on what's really happening and understand how their government works.
Well, let me ask you this. If you were to say that you have two or three priorities as you face that new public office, what would you say are your top priority items, things you want to see get done for the city?
Two that come springing to mind. One is our neighborhoods that I said needed attention, is to make that happen. I've worked with the city for a while, just kind of as a resident, you know, trying to help the process and, you know, do some landscape improvements on Seacrest, just kind of trying to make our neighborhoods better. And I found that we really need to educate, or we need to focus our city staff on doing this, you know, making sure that they understand that there's work to be done here and that it's their responsibility. So, you know, neighborhoods spring to mind first, and the obvious second, or the obvious other important issue that's going to be, you know, on the front burner is how we're going to develop our federal corridor, because that development will be coming in short order. You know, the economy's improving, and we've got people looking at these properties, and we need to get our hands wrapped around what we want that to look like. So those are two pretty tall orders. And those are really just the two. Those are the two that really can. We have focused our attention on the Congress Corridor in Boynton Beach, and we've done a great job with that. It's time to now focus our attention on the eastern side of Boynton Beach and, you know, get the job done there.
Okay. Let me ask you this. Mm-hmm. For people who want to support your candidacy, sir, how can they get in touch with your campaign? How can they donate money to your cause? Just tell us how we can help out the Alan Hendricks for City Commission.
Yeah, I love that. The easiest way is to go to our campaign website, They, of course, can find us on Facebook, but they can find us on Facebook from our campaign website, and they can find out, you know, about our platform and, you know, events that are happening. The address is allanhendricks.com.
Okie doke. AlanHendricks.com. That's fantastic. And that's where they would go if they want to volunteer as well, right?
Absolutely.
Okie doke. Well, Alan, we wish you the best of luck with your campaign.
Thank
wish you,
you
every
Alan,
success.
Sir.
And you have to come back on after you get elected and tell us about your plans once you're there, okay?
Absolutely.
Well, you take care, my friend, and best of luck.
All right, Rick. Appreciate it.
Okay, bye-bye.
Thanks, bye.
Okay. That was our friend Alan Hendricks, who is a candidate for City Commission in Boynton Beach, Florida. And we hope if you've heard good progressive things and ideas from Alan, you'll support his candidacy. Remember, the more progressives we get in office, the better off we are in the long run. It's like building a farm team, you know. You got to start them out and get them up there into higher and higher positions. I want to mention another couple things that are important to us. You know, there's a lot of good progressives on the air. A lot of good progressives are getting the word out. I want to mention our colleagues, Gwen Berry and her There Be Monsters show. It's also on Blog Talk. In fact, it happens to be on an hour before this show, and you should let her know. And like all these good progressive shows online, you can always listen to them. They're all stored as podcasts. Even if you can't catch her live from 6 to 7, you can always tune in anytime. You're going to look for There Be Monsters, okay? Also want to mention the Susan Nylon show, the Nylon Report. She's broadcast live out of Sarasota, Monday through Friday. And you can look her up online, the Nylon Report, Susan Nylon, another good progressive voice. Another excellent progressive voice, Brian Stetton, whose show Progress Toward Democracy is on Monday nights and Friday nights. Make sure you catch it. It's an excellent progressive voice on the internet radio. And also I want to mention another one of our favorites, Harriet Lehrman's show, Voice of the People. So make sure you tune into these other progressive shows. This way, if we keep supporting them, pretty soon there'll be progressives you can listen to all the live long day. It's not just the right wing on the news, it's progressive voices. And here on this show, Progressive News Network, you hear not just government officials, you hear not just leaders and business, you hear the voice of progressive activists who are doing the work every day to make this a better world. These people aren't sitting around going, well, you know, it's a problem, man. Can't do nothing about it. These are people who every day are engaged to make this a better world. They, just like you, know that you can't just sit around and hope things get better. You got to put your shoulders to the wheel. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome our good friend, Jay Alexander, whose work is on developing the new, improved Civilian Conservation Corps. Jay, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on tonight. And it's a real opportune time. I just wanted to tell listeners, thanks for listening to me and across Florida and across the nation about a program that was here 70 years ago, and now it is coming back as a bill in Congress. It was it put over 3.5 million young men to work, put work boots on the ground all over this country, all 48 states back then, and the territories of Hawaii and Alaska, and also Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico and the Caribbean. And now we have four more territories or colonial holdings out there in the Pacific that can be brought aboard. And we could send, instead of our young men and women in military age, if they're fit and they're able to do some hard labor and get along with one another in a setting in the rural, you know, wilderness areas of our country, it could be a success like it was back in the 1930s under the Roosevelt administration. So,
Jay, it
I just
seems
wanted to pass
to be
that on to people.
I'm sorry. It just
Go
seems
ahead.
To be that the Civilian Conservation Corps or that kind of project is such a win-win. You know, you not only give people work, you not only put food in their stomachs and a roof over their head, you not only give people that power that comes from being able to earn your own bread. But also, our country still benefits from that investment. What was it, 1930s? My God, we still see cathedrals. We still see parks. We still see roads. We still see amphitheaters that were built back then. My God, what a great investment, you know? Jay, tell us what that bill is and who's sponsoring. We need to push these people to make sure this gets done. What's that bill called?
We have a bill. It's the 21st Century Civilian Conservation Corps Act. It's by Marcy Kaptur. She is a representative from Toledo, Ohio. She's a very progressive person, a representative in Congress. She's been there for 30 years. There is talk of her running for U.S. Senate in the up there in Ohio. But this bill is very good for everyone in every state in the U.S. And I ask people to contact their representatives wherever they live, and they could do that via letter, via fax, via telephone call to their congressman or their or woman from now until the end of this Congress. The bill has been changed. It's evolved now. It's been in three Congresses. It's been in 111th, 112th, and now it's 113th. And I just wanted to pass out that it was the 100 and, it was the 73rd Congress that passed the bill back in 1933, and now it's the 113th, 40 Congresses later. Excuse me. And, you know, it's four score years ago that President Roosevelt put his pen down and made it into law. Maybe we could have excuse me.
Why don't you take a minute, maybe drink water or something.
Got something down my throat.
Oh,
anyway,
sorry about that, buddy.
Yeah.
What is that bill number, sir?
188. It's H.R. 188, House Resolution 188. And so far we have zero co-sponsors, and it's laying dormant in the House Education and Labor Committee, now called Workforce Committee. The past 2 years, we got four members of that committee to sign on the bill, all members in the Democratic Party. And so far, the only members of Congress signing that bill is our Democrats. So we have to go across the line because this is a win-win, no-brainer. And Republicans should be coming on and signing this bill. We have two members in Florida that have co-sponsored the bill, Kathy Castor of Tampa and Alcee Hastings of Miami have co-sponsored the bill. And a fellow in Orlando has indicated that he will co-sponsor it very shortly, and that's Alan Grayson.
Excellent.
So if we could get more people to contact their members of Congress and move on it, they could have their children or grandchildren working in here on our own lands and soils and waterways instead of seeing them halfway across the world.
You mean they could be rebuilding America instead of Afghanistan or Iraq?
Right. They could be building our country instead of rebuilding theirs.
I just hope they can bomb us first before we rebuild.
They would. That's the kind. Maybe we should bomb ourselves, and maybe we could give ourselves some foreign aid.
We get Halliburton to bribe someone to let him rebuild it, you know?
Exactly. No big contracts to rebuild our own country.
Do you have any of that bill language with you, sir?
I could look it up real quick.
Why don't you go ahead, take a minute, do that, because I think it'd be good for people to hear exactly what we're talking about.
Okay, good. I'll bring it up.
Go ahead.
And the bill number is the same bill from the last bill, is H.R. 494, and it's to authorize the president to reestablish the CCC as a means of providing gainful employment to unemployed and underemployed citizens of the United States through performance of useful public works and for other purposes. It reads similar to the bill passed by President Roosevelt in 1933, March 31st, 1933. And Ms. Kaptur introduced the following bill, and it was referred to the Committee on Education and the Workforce. Before it was the Education and Labor in the 111th Congress.
You wouldn't know who's chair of that committee, would you?
The chairman of that committee, hang on. I think it's Congressman John Klein of Wisconsin, a Republican.
Okay.
Let's see. I could look him up really, really fast here. So
we know who to encourage. I won't say harass. I'll say encourage.
Right.
Encourage.
Now, this is a national bill.
Yes.
And as citizens, you can call any of these people and say that you are an interested citizen and you heard this from an organization and you're part of. Every citizen in this country can be part of the organization I'm forming right now, or formed here in Florida. It's a 501c4, and it's called CCC Initiative Incorporated, and we're based out of St. Petersburg, Florida. That's CCCI Incorporated. Let's just say that you're an interested party with that, and a citizen, and also a constituent of your congressman. But you can call up members that are in the committee, in the education committee. I'm looking up the committees right now. Education Workforce Committee have, I think, one member that is right here in Florida. And I think that's, let's see, hang on. I could be wrong. I think the last member that was in Florida was Ross, Dennis Ross, but I don't see anybody from Florida now.
Okay.
That's in there.
Well, Jay, you're go ahead. I'm sorry.
Okay, but anyway, we have 22 members, House members that are Republicans, and there we have 17 Democrats. And the ranking member is George Miller of California, and then the representative of the chair of the committee is John Klein. And so most of the I'll tell you that Raul Grijalva, he's up for being the next Department of Interior secretary, but he signed on to it twice. And trying to look at
excellent,
other people.
Excellent, excellent leader in Congress.
So that's in that, and then Robert Scott signed it. He's from Virginia, from the Norfolk area, and he signed it He signed it last time on the 112th. So, and then Marcia Fudge from Ohio signed it too. So she's on the committee, but. These are the people you have to get in contact, is the people on the committee and on both sides. So there's 22 Republicans and 17 Democrats. And if people want to contact me to help, I'm willing to give them the spiel. And
go ahead,
contact,
Jay.
My phone number is 727-525-8769. Congress is now in session, and we could both get on the line. And you could contact our member or your member together and give them the spiel about bringing this program back and talking with a legislative assistant or their chief of staff and leaving them with a message. Or even if you know the member of Congress, we could speak to them, him or her, and ask them politely to look into co-sponsorship of this bill if they're in their office at this time in Washington or if they're at home in their district. I think they're home in the district from the last week of each month. But now, since it's the first week of January, they're back in Congress. They're back in session.
At least for a day or two at a time.
Right. You know, then they take their maybe their
5-day weekend.
They spend it, but maybe on a golf course or
hey,
or
Jay,
somewhere else.
you're a really busy guy. You're not just involved in reviving this CCC. You're also involved in the veterans movement, aren't you?
Right. And also I'm a public servant. I just was elected in office in November. So,
and why don't you tell us what office were you elected to, sir?
Okay. I'm a fire commissioner in a little unincorporated district here, fire district. It's a special fire district. There's about 20 of them in Florida. And I'm in one of them in Pinellas County. It's called Lelman Special Fire District, and I'm in. We have three engines. We have engine 18, 19, and 21, and we spread out. We're spread out in a area of about a mile wide area to about 7 miles long. So we're about maybe 70. I guess you could say that's about a seven square mile area of Pinellas County. It's below Pinellas Park, and between St. Petersburg and on our west side is Seminole, and inside of our perimeter is Kansas City. And we are fighting battles of acquisition to our area for tax reasons. We're fighting those municipalities for illegal appropriation of the lands. So I'm now involved with county officials and also the city of different cities, these four different cities right now, or three different cities. And we're just a special fire district, and we're trying to keep integrity of the area so we could serve the people.
Well, you keep up the good work there, buddy. Tell us a little bit about your veterans work.
And also I'm the I founded a chapter here for Veterans for Peace back in 2005, and we're reforming our chapters to take in – we used to be called Tampa Bay, but it was too large of an area. So now we're just going into sections that could serve our populations better. So we started a St. Petersburg chapter. We're starting a Clearwater chapter soon. We started and formed a Tampa chapter over in Tampa, Florida. And hopefully we'll get members of the veterans to look into joining our organization. Non-veterans are welcome too. Dependents are welcome to be on board. And so far it looks promising to bring out progressive politics into our for our veterans that are serving now and for our servicemen that are now retired. We have about 100,000 retirees right here in the Tampa Bay area.
Well, that's great.
And then one of the major bases in the world is right here. It's called MacDill Air Force Base, and it's the headquarters for Central Command and Special Operations. So there's two commands here, and we have so much brass here we can make a Liberty Bell.
So I guess the veterans access and veterans hospital facilities are pretty good then.
Yeah, we have two of the finest here, Bay Pines and Hanley Hospital, I think it's called. But anyway, that's in Tampa, and the other one's in St. Petersburg, Seminole area. And then we have some clinics around, too.
Excellent. Jay, thank you so much for joining us, sir.
Thank you very much. And if people want to look up the bill, they can go to congress.org, or they could find out their members of Congress through that, and then they could go to to see what the bill is, just type in HR 188, and it'll put CCC Act behind it, and it should come up right to the bill and to the verbiage of the bill. You could look it online right there, and there's a very good section on there about how this bill would purchase. There's a petition going around Florida. There's about 12 states that have in their constitutions a bill that monies that go directly to a fund that purchase lands for the state, and they're in different states around the union, and we're trying to get one in 2014. But this bill has a clause in it that would purchase lands or to take donations that or take lands from eminent domain and they could put CCC projects to work on those lands. And back in Roosevelt's times, they got 20 million acres, which included the Great Smoky Mountain National Park. So they went all around the country and purchased and gained lands. So most of the lands in northwest Georgia, the Chattahoochee National Forest, was purchased during the 1930s. And that's where the watershed of the Atlanta area is. So,
well, thanks again, Jay. We sure appreciate you joining us.
Thank you very much, sir. And if anybody wants to call me, it's 727-525-8769. If you want to call Congress, call up the operator at 202-224-3121. And if they want to look at our website, our old website is still up at wecantakeit.org. And we're putting up a new one, goccci.org. Thank you.
Thanks, Jay. Take care, buddy. Bye-bye.
Will do. Peace. Bye.
Peace. Hi there. You're on Progressive News Network. Can I help you?
Oh, yeah, my name is Bob Carlson, and I was trying to ask a question of Jay.
Oh, I'm sorry, Bob. If
he,
you want to go and ask your question and tell
us
what
you think.
He
requested me to call in to the
show. Oh, I'm terribly sorry. I wish he'd, wish he'd mentioned it.
You know, stuff happens, and most of it happens to me. He and I were actually on a show just a couple of weeks ago on Blog Talk Radio talking about the CCC and about climate change, and he wanted me to talk a little bit about that, so I guess I can butt in for a couple of minutes if you...
Sure, sure. I got 5 minutes for you. Go ahead.
All right. My name is Bob Carlson. I'm originally from San Francisco, but I've been stuck in St. Louis for a long time, and, you know... You guys are all Floridians. I have to say, I tip my hat to certain authors from that state, especially, oh, gosh. who writes all the third storm stuff?
Why don't you go ahead and go on, make your other point.
Yeah. Tim Dorsey. That's it. Tim Dorsey.
Okay.
Wonderful guy. Anyway, but crazy, crazy author, lovely, funny, funniest guy. Well, Jay wanted me to talk a little bit. I used to be a state environmental inspector for several years, and I've taught environmental cleanup classes for a long time. And with this, Jay's great idea for bringing back the CCC, we've got the infrastructure to work on, and we have climate change to work on, no question about it. I mean, we've seen what happened with Hurricane Sandy and Katrina and Rita and now this new multi-storm system on the East Coast. We are also, with any luck, dragging our military people back from you know, Afghanistan and Iraq and everything, and they're going to need something to do, and training is able to be provided. I've been teaching hazardous waste cleanup for 20 years. It was kind of a little grim for me when I taught some people who went down to do the cleanup after Katrina down there in New Orleans. And they came back a year later for their refresher training, and they said they were still finding bodies. Right? This is not something you can just walk into as a job. You have to have some training and some knowledge and everything else. And with all the climate change that's going on, in some areas, you know, if the Gulf Stream shuts down as it might, then there might even be a little ice age, even though the rest of the globe will get warmer. And so there's going to be a huge need for people trained to do public works kind of work, like what Jay is suggesting and what his HB 188 is all about. So I just wanted to give him a fist in the air, you know, for his efforts, because he's doing great work. He's doing it almost solo, I think. Those of us here and there support his efforts, but, you know, it really, I'm glad that you had him on and discussed that.
Oh, he's a great guy. He's been on several times, and it's such a useful, important idea. I told him from the beginning, it's a win-win-win for the country.
Yeah.
It's good for people, it's good for jobs, and it's good for the history.
Well, and what's interesting is that I'm an old hippie from, as I said, San Francisco, an old Renaissance fair, a long-haired dude and everything. And my parents, though, are total Republicans. They're Tea Partiers now. And I even broached the CCC.
You're not alone, brother. You're not alone.
Yeah, I know. We all have to have something to rebel against. But I broached the whole concept of bringing back the CCC to my dad, who was a cranky old conservative. And he said, well, I'm not against the idea, but where's the money going to come from? And I said, well, the military budget, for Christ's sake. You know, we got to bring them home anyway.
Not a toughie.
And they're overfunded anyway. And maybe, you know, cut out the drones and start funding, you know, tree plantings and stuff. And the other thing is, though, and Jay asked me to ask about this. I was hoping to get on while he was online, but that's okay. If we do acquire some more public land, and that's always a good idea because we're holding it in reserve. Talk about conservation, conservatism. Yeah, we're holding that land and protecting it.
You remember when conservative meant that too?
Yeah, probably not, but. But a lot of that land might have been dumped on by people in the past, especially by our military. And right now in St. Louis, there's a big panic over this creek where a bunch of radioactive waste was dumped back in the 40s and 50s because a lot of the nuclear materials were processed here building the initial A-bombs.
What's your take on that?
Well, I used to inspect that area. I used to live in that area. And, yeah, there are some higher rates of cancer and whatnot associated with some of the dump sites. But they've been there for 50 years or longer. And some of that has already kind of tapered off, worn off, half-life of various materials. And the problem with this is it's not a non-issue, but people panic, and then they want to blame everything on that instead of the dry cleaner that used to be on the corner that had leaking underground storage tanks. And
what?
And the gas station and the auto body shop that were around, you know, across the street. It's important that people don't just go with a single issue and freak out. You know, they need to kind of look into all the elements that are involved, and that's kind of, I don't know, that's why I'm a consultant, I guess.
One of the things that I've learned over the years covering environmental stories is that you're constantly asked the question when you talk to consultants, you talk to bureaucrats, they're, well, yep, it's going to kill me right away, because if it's not going to kill me right away, I don't really want to hear about it.
Yeah, there's
it,
acute
that
versus
kind of
chronic.
Thinking,
yeah.
I think it's just so counterproductive.
You're totally right. Short attention span theater is what I call it. Now, back when I was a state guy, you know, there would be these people that would bitch and moan about a 4-cent tax, you know, to fund the department. And, oh, you guys are in our pockets all the time. But I'll tell you what, as soon as a mystery drum leaking glowing green crap showed up in the backyard, in the back alley where their kids might play, we couldn't get there soon enough. And I talk about this on my blog, so I guess I might as well mention it while I'm on.
Please
here.
Do. Please do.
It's called the Hazard Hot Sheet. Three words, Hazard Hot Sheet. Just Google it, you'll find it. And I also talk about animal rescue work because that's what I do. I rescue stray and feral and abandoned cats and dogs whenever I can. I just can't have any in my building. So I help the doggies, but I can't bring them in. But I help the kitties a lot. And there's a great outfit called Alley Cat Allies, if anybody wants to look them up. And they do TNR work, which is trap, neuter, and return. And a very good program. So, the Hazard Hot Sheet, I sort of BS about environmental stuff, including, you know, I taught OSHA courses and EPA courses and MSHA and DOT and DOE, radiation, mold, you name it, for 20 years. So I talk about workplace hazards, but I talk about household hazards. You know, there are things that you have under your bathroom sink that are just as bad as what you're exposed to at work, but nobody ever bothers to read the label.
Bob, can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
You mentioned training people for the Makonda blowout, which, as you mentioned, the 3-minute memory has disappeared from almost everybody's psyche. When you heard the official news that all that Corexit and oils just disappear, did you laugh or just shake your head in sorrow?
A little bit of both. Because, of course, you know, months go by and they found that a lot of that stuff balled up and sunk. You know, there's a great photo of Jay Alexander with a sign about tar balls, you know. And, yeah, this stuff comes washing up months later. There was a minke whale that beached itself in Texas just a couple of days ago, and they managed to get it back out to sea, but not sure if it was in good shape enough to do that or not. Sometimes when they beach themselves, they've got ear parasites or something that's messing up their navigation. But sometimes also they're contaminated by all the oil that got spilled. I don't know. You have to laugh and you have to cry at the same time. And I'm just here as an observer. But, you know, I worked for Greenpeace back in San Francisco for years, and then I was a state hazardous waste investigator, enforcement guy. I've been a consultant for law firms on these issues. I've taught courses for a long time. I've been on almost every side of this issue that you can, and so I try to share my knowledge. But Congress hasn't pumped any money into the Superfund Act since 1996, which is why me and a lot of people I know are rather broke. It's not that there's a shortage of sites that need to be cleaned up. That's not the issue at all. It's just that they're not funding it, and they should be. And if we're going to acquire some of these lands under the CCC, then we need to make sure they're clean, or if they're not, we need to get people in there trained and get in there and clean them up.
I was working with
a... That's what they were asking me to speak about. So,
I was working with a civil engineering firm mapping underground abandoned facilities back in the early 80s, late 80s. And it was explained to me. I said, well, you know, all right, now that we've mapped all these underground sites and we know where the dry cleaners have been, we know where the old auto shops were, we know where the petroleum facilities are. I said, so when is the part of it going to take place that they're going to clean this up? And he said, oh, no, the money's basically wasted on the investigation. There's no money left for cleanup.
as somebody with 6 years of university, five different majors in the sciences as well as education, but who's all of my male relatives are engineers. And so there's a great joke that I stole from the back page of Scientific American about 10 years ago that I love to use. It's like, what do engineers use for birth control? Their personalities. And but you're totally right. You know, they do spend money on the investigation. There is under CERCLA, the Comprehensive Environmental Response Compensation Liability Act of 1980, as amended by SARA, the Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act of 1986. There is an emergency fund. Okay, there's a separate chunk of money. Because if there are, you know, leaky drums in the back alley, the emergency fund pays for people to come and pop them into 85-gallon overpack drums and get them off of there so the kiddies can't play around them. For the long-term soil and groundwater cleanup, that's going to have to come out of the major superfund. And, again, Congress hasn't pumped any money into it since 1996. You know, we've got this law on the books, and it isn't doing a damn bit of good anymore. And a lot of people I know, I had a friend who had a drilling company, and one of his main clients was a railroad company, and they would go and take core samples along the rights of way and whatnot to see if there was any contamination. Of course, there usually was, PCBs and stuff like that. But now he makes his living installing fluorescent light fixtures in new construction because the environmental field dried up. You know, the bottom fell out of the whole industry back in about 96. And it's unfortunate because, again, there's no shortage of sites that need cleanup. We have to reassess our priorities. And most people, again, aren't going to care until it's their kids that are being exposed. And then they're all hot under the collar and you can't get there fast enough. It's
the state of Florida, where we live, is... had a program where they were looking for citizens to collect data on the local lake system. They called it the Lake Project.
Okay.
And all they were doing was looking for particulates. There was no actual chemical analysis involved at all. Just particulates, right?
Just turbidity, huh?
Yeah. Which is,
why even fund something like that in the first place except to make people feel good, I guess.
Exactly. Well, at one point, you know, I asked the scientists that I was turning my reports into, and I was very meticulous, and I did this data collection for 6 months, and I said, you know, let me ask you a question. Beyond, you know, somebody writing a feel-good report, these basically are going to sit in a filing cabinet, right?
Yeah.
And he goes, well, yeah, but, you know, real things happen from this. And I said, well, give me a for instance. He said, well, as a matter of fact, a young man was interested in the the runoff from one of our big trash mountains.
Yep.
And so he sampled the canal immediately adjacent. Now, of course, everyone's been assured that this thing is totally sealed and the plate between the pollution and the ground is completely impermeable and nothing like this can ever happen. Now, the fact that it's adjacent to a national park in the bay really, you know, irrelevant. But anyway, he said this young man actually paid to have the testing done, and he found that the ammonia level in this canal was 2,000 times the state level.
I see.
And he said this as if this was going to show me that really good has come from this. I said, all right, now, let me ask you this, Mr., you know, limnologist. Now that we know this, who has been informed? He said, well, like what? I said, all right, so the young man's going to get himself an A on his science fair project. We know that. That's a good thing. Now, yeah. Have you told the Department of Solid Waste? Have you told the environmental community? Have you told the State Department of Water? Have you told the National Park? Have you told the EPA? And his response was, do you think I should?
Didn't know I was supposed to, right?
And, you know, I thought he's either so stark, raving naive or immensely stupid. I didn't think he was cagey.
I would just say that there's a huge gap in the gestalt for everybody in the modern world. There's, you know, Alvin Toffler wrote the book Future Shock back in the 70s that anticipated all this, where people are just having to process too much information all at once to really be able to pay attention to any issue in particular unless they become obsessive compulsive. And I guess that's where we are. One of my many majors was anthropology, along with chemistry.
Subject.
Yeah, along with chemistry and archaeology and astronomy and physics, and you know, my degree is in earth sciences. so that's geology and meteorology and oceanography and all that other stuff
right.
comes in very handy. But even archaeology comes in handy sometimes. One time, I got called in because this contractor was digging up some old gasoline tanks from a gas station that had been closed for 25 years, and underneath. Somehow or other, wow, what's all this? They dug up an old German cemetery from the late 1840s here in St. Louis that was a single-use cemetery because we had a gigantic outbreak of cholera in this town back then. So they had to have a place to bury everybody who died from it. And we didn't expect to see that, so we had to call in the state archaeologist and medical expert to make sure those bacteria wouldn't still be viable. You never, as I tell my students, you know, and you were paraphrasing me earlier where I say, does that make sense? You never know what you're going to find until you dig. So,
well, you know, a funny thing.
As we said in the Boy Scouts, be prepared.
This limnologist I was talking to who had been accepting this data from me for 6 months, he said, well, you know, if you really think I should tell someone, who do you think I should tell?
Everybody.
I said, well, you know,
well,
I'd start
everybody.
With, you know, your supervisors at the DER, the environmental quality people. And I said, the EPA would probably be a good call, and solid waste wouldn't be out of place. And you know what? By the next week, he had been relocated. And I'm sure it was a coincidence.
Yeah. Well, you know, the squeaky wheel sometimes gets the axe. I just made that up.
When I told the county commissioner, she said, you know, that's just one more thing. I said, no. It's poisoning a national park.
Let me tell you something. when I was a state guy, the public, you know, as I like to say this, they need not only to be concerned, but to be informed.
Sure.
Okay? And I would get calls routed to me. When I was a state guy, I did hazardous waste, solid waste, infectious waste, underground tanks, and Superfund, all of those. And I would get calls every now and again, well, all the time, really, from confused citizens who didn't know who to call to ask about this or that problem. They would ask the sewer district. They would get bounced over to the air pollution program in the city. They'd get bounced over to the county, blah, blah, blah. And the secretaries at the Missouri Department of Natural Resources, St. Louis Regional Office, would almost always route those calls to me because they knew that I gave I hope I can say shit, because I did. And I did, you know, and I used to give talks to school groups from kindergarten to university, industry groups, church groups, anybody who was interested in hearing a little bit about what they could do to get involved. Parks departments, you know, who knows?
Bob, unfortunately, I need to ask you to wrap up, buddy, because I have to get two more pieces up.
Okay, well, the last thing that I would say is just to go ahead and kind of cruise Google and look up the hazard hot sheet because
definitely.
I do try to be entertaining on there.
Oh, Bob, listen, I want to have you back again.
Oh, I'd be happy to.
That'd be fantastic. I got your phone number, and please check out the show. You've added tremendously to it. Thank you so much. And, Bob, I do definitely want to have you back again. Thank you so much.
I appreciate it greatly, Rick.
And we'll have you on for some more time next time, okay?
All right. You take care.
Okay, man. Take care.
And Gung Hei Fat Choi. It's Chinese New Year.
Okay, yeah. Year of the Water Snake, right?
Yeah.
Okay, you take care.
All right. Bye.
Bye. That's good. Thank you, Bob. Glad to hear that was mentioned. Okay, now I want to play you this interview we did with Reverend Gary Wilson, who's going to talk about an event next week. And let's see here. Here we go, Reverend Wilson. Good morning, Reverend Wilson. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing okay.
Oh, that's good. That's good. Want to welcome you to Progressive News Network and ask you to tell me a little bit about this this wonderful event, and tell me a little about the work that you do, sir.
Well, I'm a minister, a Unitarian Universalist minister in Brevard, Melbourne, Florida. And part of our, I guess, church's mission is to participate in the community about educating the community of what's going on in our world and in our local communities and concerning social justice and justice issues. And this conference is an outcome of that ministry, of the justice ministry, and our commitment to living in a healthy environment and our commitment to promoting the democratic process in our society. We have called together, if I had to rename the conference, I'd rename it Healing Our World, Healing Our Democracy, and Healing Ourselves. There's three components. We have brought together three really international speakers: Sister Pat Seaman, who is the executive director of the Earth Jurisprudence Legal Department at Barry University; David Cobb, who is going around the country and has been doing so for a number of years, addressing the issue of corporate personhood, which is corporations having human rights. Yeah, they have legal rights in our legal system, primarily given to them by the Supreme Court, which is interesting because the Supreme Court has been charged with ensuring our elections and our democracy, which means a decentralization of power, because democracy is about the people, so it's a decentralization of power. And when you award corporations human rights, one of the outcomes is the centralization of power. So the Supreme Court has actually made rulings that centralizes power, the very thing they're not supposed to be doing. And we brought together this other speaker, which I think is very helpful to helping with a spiritual end of the program, and that is Bruce Alexander, who has written a book 2 years ago called The Globalization of Addiction. And his basic premise is that hyper-capitalism, capitalism without regulations, really dislocates people psychically and physically. It can move into your neighborhood, an industry, a transnational corporation can move into your neighborhood, really ruin your neighborhood, either drive you out or ruin your way of life, which is a form of dislocation. And as a result of this dislocation, human beings respond addictively. We create addictive personalities, whether we numb ourselves out by television or by relationships or by, you know, drugs, alcohol, whatever it might be. We actually stop paying attention to what's going on in our communities because we feel hopeless and powerless. So this conference is, in a way, an empowerment process. And when you come from the perspective of the rights of nature, you get three basic rights that are central, and they are the rights to exist, the rights to a healthy habitat, and the right to thrive. And you would think, well, okay, of course. But there's a case in Pennsylvania, and you can find it on the Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund website, where this corporation came in and used really sludge. They call it sludge sewage, but it's everything that comes down out of your toilet. They're putting this on the farmland, and they have a right to do that. The 16-year-old boy breathed that, got a staph infection, and died. So in a sense, he did not have a right to exist. So the right to exist is not just, oh, yes, of course we all do. No, the corporation has the right to exist and do what it did, but the corporation's right to exist and do what it did meant that that 16-year-old boy who died did not have a right to exist, much less a right to a healthy habitat, much less a right to thrive. But when you apply that to all of nature, then you begin to say, well, in my neck of the woods, the Indian River Lagoon has a right to exist, has a right to a healthy habitat, has a right to thrive. Well, then, you know, what does that mean in relationship to putting fertilizers on our lawn, in relationship to the sugar industry, in relationship to the fact that presently the Indian River Lagoon is literally dying? So we've got a speaker to address those issues coming in. Now, the corporations having human rights, can you imagine a corporation having human rights? The outcome of 100 years of that practice has really changed our democracy. And our Constitution, Congress, the House, has the responsibility and the charge to regulate commerce. Now, here's a corporation, and to incorporate is an act of commerce, so Congress has the charge to regulate that. But then these corporations get human rights to protect them against the regulation from Congress. So Congress can't regulate them the way the people would want them to be regulated because they've got these federal protections. And so the Constitution is fundamentally changed in that. And so the Move to Amend movement is saying we need to remove those rights, those human rights, away from corporations so that we can actually restore the Constitution to some of its original intent. I love Justice Scalia when he says that I'm a originalist, I'm a conservative when it comes to the Constitution. Well, actually, he's not. He's quite liberal when it comes to the Constitution because he takes a liberal interpretation and affirms the rights of corporations having human rights. So actually, he is very liberal. And I think the whole court, and I was trying to find some information on that, regards corporations as persons. And we certainly know Mitt Romney does because he said it out loud. The piece I think that's we really need to pay attention to is this globalization of addiction. Because as long as we are living under, in a way, I guess you could say, tyranny, or in a way of transnational corporations writing our laws and structuring our society, as long as which disempowers us and interrupts our representational democracy, as long as the effects of that addictive, in a way, society and addictive personality that has developed, we don't really confront these other issues with full force. We kind of become apathetic, numb, sense of powerlessness, and we really feel as a people, what's the sense? Why vote? It doesn't make any difference anyway. Both parties are the same. Those are addictive statements. Rather than saying, well, if both parties are the same, we're going to create a third party so we have somebody that represents us to vote for. So I'm bringing those three pieces together. I think we can create a dialogue that will help wake people up, change our consciousness, and begin to engage our democracy in a way that is healthy for us.
Reverend Wilson, no one could fault the plan for taking on small issues. Those are three really, really complex and major issues in our life today. The healing ourselves, the studying addiction, the impact of corporations on our civic life, and also the earth and all its living creatures having a right to exist. Three major categories of challenges that affect us every day. Obviously, you're bringing people together from quite a ways away. How many people do you expect at this conference?
Right now, we have over 90 people registered and committed to come, and we still have over a week, so we don't know how many more will come, you know, after that. So we're hoping to have over 100 people to come, and we chose the larger issues. And if you follow the flow, if you look at the outline of the conference, the way the conference moves is that on Saturday afternoon, I think we have over 12 local groups from the Indian River Lagoon, river keepers, to different water rights groups, to climate change down from Miami, to a variety of groups coming, and they engage the three primary speakers with these larger, more complex ideas. And in that conversation, my hope is that we can see how we take these larger ideas, then begin to actually implement them on the local level. That's the goal of the conference, is to say, yes, these are large, complex ideas, and there's truth to these ideas, and we would agree somewhat on a continuum what that truth is, but how do we implement these ideas? How do we bring these ideas to the local level? Well, that's the purpose of the conference, take the big ideas, bring people who are engaged in local communities and have the conversation, how do we implement these big ideas in our city council, in our county council, in our local ordinances? How do we give the people literally standing in court to shape their local community rather than their local community being shaped by transnational corporations?
This is really sounds like an absolutely fantastic, interesting conference. You know, there's so many things I would love to ask you about it. And let me ask you a little bit, how did you get involved in this project?
Number one, I'm a citizen of this country. Number two, I love the country, and I've been trained or taught about the formation of our nation, the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, World War I, World War II, and have a certain amount of pride in our nation being a free nation. And then it was really after the election of Bill Clinton that I became somewhat confused, I would say, because I know what he ran on and the promises he made. Then when he got in office, he really went the opposite direction. And with the passing of NAFTA, I thought, what is this? So I began to be concerned about our democracy and read Tom Hartman's book, Unequal Protection, and then discovered that the Supreme Court for over 100 years had been giving corporations civil liberties, and was quite shocked to discover that, like, what are you doing? And then became aware of that tension between corporations running our country and we the people running our country, and so began to be alarmed about that and studying that and talking about that. And then in studying that, bumped into the rights of nature. And whenever you read the introduction to the rights of nature, people began to introduce that concept with this thought: the planet is dying. And at first I went, you know, it's a big planet. What do you mean the planet's dying? And every year we pump 38 billion tons of pollutants into this living system, the Earth. Well, you can't pump poison into a living system and not have it affected. And then I started reading about dead zones. And the dead zones, I think there's 140 dead zones on our planet, and they're intensifying and growing. And then I thought, wow, could it really be that our planet's dying? You know, and I don't want to go there emotionally, because what do you do with that? But the more I read, the more I thought, wow, these people are really onto something. And their answer is, we have to create a legal system that's not economic centered and that's not favors a particular group of people. We have to create a legal system that protects the whole living system of the planet. And when I discovered that, I went, yes, that's an answer that would work. So if we remove the corporate personhood rights and re-empower the people in our democracy, and we create a legal system that respects and protects all living systems, that might work. So rather than feeling hopeless and overwhelmed, I thought, wow, maybe this is a window. This is a window that can work. And the faith tradition I'm in, the Unitarian Universalist, this is congruent with their values. So in a way, I'm really in a winning position, at least intellectually, because every community I'm in, I think, is grabbing on to something that's a real answer to the problems that we face. And then when I ran into, and then after studying those two, I ran into Bruce Alexander's work. I mean, I'm familiar with the codependency, we live in an addictive society by Ann Chaff Wilson, and that kind of work. My pastoral theological training talks about the numbness of our culture spiritually. So I've got that in my history. And then when I read Bruce Alexander's work, the globalization of addiction, I mean, it just went off like a light. Yes, that is a problem. That intensified capitalism, where you put an economic system and value an economic system over the life of people and over the life of the planet, how else are we going to respond but numb ourselves out? The piece that I think really needs to be developed, and the conference will address this somewhat, is that we don't have a recovery process from the globalization of addiction that deals with it directly, with Bruce Alexander's work. So I'm hoping that the conference will begin to move people's curiosity. How do we develop recovery groups and recovery communities in relationship to this globalization of addiction? My hope is that every Unitarian Universalist church after this conference would start a recovery group, and be a place where people could come and at least talk about these issues and not be laughed at or not to be dismissed, but to really engage them in a serious way. And so that's how I got interested. I knew there was something wrong with our democracy, and I knew there was something wrong with what was going on in the environment, and I know there's something wrong with us spiritually to have enabled this group of people to move our whole world in a condition where life is being threatened. So I'm out there looking for answers, and then not just answers, but what can I do? What can I do that would really have meaning? I don't want to waste my life in doing things that doesn't have any meaning. So this conference is saying these are avenues that have meaning and are addressing the real issues of our day.
Well, it is an absolutely laudable idea. You brought together important people who are going to be addressing very, very troubling issues. It sounds like you've got some really good ways of addressing some of these. Let me just play devil's advocate just for a moment, because while I'm with you, I can hear in our troubled society some of the voices are going to be raised against you. And I have to admit, some of these are for example, one of the things I can imagine someone saying, who is somewhat out of sympathy with your description, is what place does a church have, or a religious institution, addressing all these civic matters? And I think there are people out there who think of themselves as conservatives, who think of themselves as maybe Christian or maybe just conservative voices, who can kind of ignore with one hand the part that the religious right has played in their politics, but yet at the same time be prepared to decry progressive religious or progressive philosophical voices. Can you address that for just a moment?
Well, up front, when I was a teenager, I was in a conservative Baptist church, accepted Jesus Christ as my personal Savior, indwelt with the Holy Spirit. Very meaningful for me. And I would say that my beginning of what I'm presenting here to you today is an expression of that experience, that the Spirit has led me in this direction, has led me to address these issues and put this voice out in our community. Now, whether the church as an institution can house that kind of thinking, that's another issue. But the House of the Unitarian Universalists, they can handle this voice. Now, not only that, but they support it. And as far as the theological position goes, here's this planet, especially from a conservative position, here's this planet that God has given us. And yet we worry about social issues that have been with us since the beginning of humanity and are not going to change, but yet the church does not move to protect the gift God has given them, this planet. How can a true believer that God created this planet tolerate 38 billion tons of pollution going to this gift that we have been given? So I get very confused with the more conservative people that they would use. And for example, the Unitarian Universalist has a legislative ministry, and the legislative ministry moves to address state legislatures and issues of justice and kindness and fairness toward people. whereas you have a more conservative group of people that would use state legislators to implement their theology. It's a distinctive difference. The Unitarian legislative ministry moves us in a direction of creating a kinder society that's fairer to all people, whereas a more conservative community uses the legal systems and uses our government to implement their theological beliefs. It's a distinct difference, so that's why I'm leaning toward the Unitarian Universalist community, because they are more moving toward fairness and justice toward all people, not necessarily concerned with particular theological beliefs. It's a freer way to live.
Well, I couldn't agree with you more. I've always found people, when I've met them in the Unity community, to be the most progressive voices in the area, and very concerned with the common humanity. Let me ask you this. I hope you're documenting this event so that more people can hear it, can enjoy what's going on, can benefit from it, then might be able to travel there. But to get to that point, how can people find out more? How can they get in touch with you? How can they arrange to travel to this event? Why don't you tell us about how people can get involved with this event?
You can certainly go to the webpage, healingourworldandourselves.org. You can go there. You can call me at 772-486-4029 for more information. But once you go to the webpage, there's a process in which you can register to Healing Our World and Ourselves. Is the webpage.
It sounds like an absolutely fantastic event, sir, and I wish you all the best of luck with it. I know you have people from across the state involved, and obviously...
And out of the state, too.
It's just amazing. We have so many challenges, whether environmental or social or political, that I think all the constructive voices we can possibly get out there with is all to the good. And how we're going to turn around this... curious Supreme Court who call themselves strict constructionist and yet find things in the Constitution that certainly the founders never did. There's no mention of corporate anything in the Constitution as I read it.
You know, if you go to James Madison's notes online, September 14th, Friday night, you'll be able to find that if you go to James Madison's notes. There was a vote not to give the federal government permission to incorporate businesses. I mean, the conversation's there. So it's not an accident it's not in the Constitution. It was voted not to be in the Constitution. It was a discussion, and they voted 8-3 not to include it.
I thought that was the case. I had heard that. Yeah, that's great. Well, Reverend Wilson, you're very well informed, and again, I wish you every success.
Thank you.
Why don't you if you would give out your phone number one more time so people can call you up.
772-486-4029.
Well, sir, maybe you'll come back afterwards and tell us about how things happened, okay?
Oh, that would be wonderful. Thank you very much.
And best of luck, sir.
Okay, thank you.
That was Reverend Gary Wilson talking about the event next week of healing ourselves, healing our planet. And I hope you get a chance to check it out. It's going to be a wonderful event. Now I'd like to bring you Professor Gentry from the U.S. Naval Academy, who's going to talk about her work to defend us from the excesses of the TSA. And here we go. Let me start by saying I'd like to welcome Ms. Summer Gentry, an educator, a professor at the Naval War College?
The U.S. Naval Academy.
U.S. Naval Academy. Thank you so much for joining us, Summer. You have been spectacularly involved in working to put an end to the TSA abuses. How's that?
Yes, that's exactly what's been my issue.
And although last time you did tell us a little bit about it, for the new listeners, why don't you give us just a thumbnail of how you got involved in this arena?
I always was offended by the TSA searching people when they had no probable cause, no reason to suspect anyone. I bought an airplane ticket, and therefore I deserved to be searched like a criminal. I always thought it was wrong. And then I had a very bad experience at Baltimore Washington Airport, where I was pulled aside for a hand wand. This is in the days when they were using the hand wand metal detectors.
Right, that's pre-naked screening.
it was before the naked scanners that I had this very bad experience. The woman put this metal detector up my skirt. I was wearing a skirt. And pushed it into my private parts, inside me.
Oh, my goodness.
Just pushed my clothing up inside me to the point that I had to go to the restroom and compose myself afterwards. And it was just disgusting. And it's, although I pursued this complaint, I never got any decent apology or resolution from the TSA. I filled out a complaint there at the airport, and then I wrote to my congressman, and my congressman got the TSA to respond to me, and their response was very telling. They said, yes, this happens sometimes, but too bad. Essentially, they said they had no intention of changing their procedures or addressing anything to prevent it from happening again to another woman.
You know, I absolutely will not make light of this. This is a terrible government intrusion. But, you know, it seems to me when we hear so many people complaining about the, quote, threat to the Second Amendment, I just wonder where the hell they are on the issue of the absolute abuse and indignities on simple citizens. And, you know, I've heard more than one of these Second Amendment enthusiasts, I'll be positive, the Second Amendment enthusiasts say, you know, I mean, my goodness, just one murder and look what happened. Well, excuse me, you know, there was one guy who smuggled a little bit of chemicals in his underwear and look at what's happened. You know, there's one guy who tried to set fire to some material in his shoes. Look at what's happened. This is not a unique situation. And if you're concerned about that, you need to be concerned about this. Far more people are not theoretically being threatened, but actually being violated in their person by these people. For what? For nothing. And to say that it provides no additional security is to just understate the case.
Absolutely. I can't understand why we aren't talking about how the entire Bill of Rights is being eviscerated here. I mean, the right to protest, First Amendment, we have restraints on where you are allowed to exercise your right to free speech. We have no right to challenge our accusers in court anymore. We could be indefinitely detained without even being charged. The rest of the amendments are important too, not just the Second Amendment. I mean, I love all of the Bill of Rights, but I don't understand why we don't have defenders of our right to protest. Where are the defenders of our right to travel where we want to within this country without being searched and treated like a criminal?
Before I let you talk about some of the good things that are happening, and there are good things happening, and that is entirely the responsibility of people like you who are fighting this and refusing to be a victim of abuses of power. I saw an article on one of the TSA news pages about a gentleman who just wrote on his body, and he was harassed for a freedom of speech issue when he didn't even speak up aloud. It was just written on his body. Are you familiar with that case?
Yes, that was Aaron Tobey, one of my new heroes. He wrote the Fourth Amendment on his chest. and had a lot of nerve. As he was approaching the scanner, he took off everything except for shorts, so he was decent, and he complied with everything the TSA asked him to do. He just silently stood there with the Fourth Amendment on his chest, and he was arrested for that
and
detained for hours.
You know, I mean, it begs the imagination. What did they charge him with, do you know?
I think disturbing the peace, but the charges were immediately dropped. The amazing thing is that there was a dissent in this case. In the recent case, the judges allowed an individual action against the TSA agents for violating his First Amendment rights, I think. And so this was a victory for us, but one of the dissenting judges said something about how by invoking the Fourth Amendment, he had created such a distraction that the TSA agents couldn't possibly keep us safe. And that just is mysterious to me, that if someone is invoking the Constitution, that means they're such a distraction at the checkpoint that the TSA agents can't search us. That makes no sense.
No, I think probably what we're really looking at is the government doesn't want anyone to remember that we have any Bill of Rights. And
yes,
you know,
no one shall sleep in a bed with sheets. right? Suddenly there are, that was a reference to
Bradley Manning,
Animal
sure.
Farm.
Oh,
but,
okay.
Yeah, sort of the law changes ever so slightly each time we go through it, and we forget that we used to actually be free of unreasonable searches and seizures.
I remember that law. You know, once I actually asked a prosecutor, I said, you know, let's speak of the government. Let's speak of the law for just a second. You're an attorney first. You're an officer of the court. You are a prosecutor. Now, in the real world, real lives are involved. Real lives are at stake. This is not about counting how many victories you have. You, as an officer of the court, must support the law. At what point did unreasonable searches and seizures go away? I never heard about that repeal. When was that? When was that Constitution amended? And he said, well, frankly, no one's really tried to stop us. And I said, well, aren't you, as an officer of the court, a defender of the law? How can you continue to do that? He really didn't have an answer, because, frankly, there is no legitimate answer to that.
Well, it's long past time for people to challenge the TSA, and in fact, there have been so many cases filed against the TSA, and they're absolutely disgusting abuse of our bodies. And the TSA has managed to get nearly all of them thrown out on technicalities. So almost never has any court ruled, in fact, I think never has any court ruled on whether a pat-down search, including genital touching, is actually permissible under the Fourth Amendment. The TSA keeps these cases out of court on a technicality based on your filing with the wrong jurisdiction.
I see there's a story about the TSA forcing a mother to pump milk out of her breast. Did they really think that she was concealing something in her breast, or was this just simple abuse of power?
I think it was abuse of power. I think, yeah, they were claiming that she couldn't bring empty milk bottles, but she could bring full milk bottles. The whole thing is so disturbing, and what gives anyone the right to say...
Okay, well, enough of that. We know there are abuses. We know people who fly every day are being forced, are being treated as if they have absolutely no First Amendment rights, Fourth Amendment rights. But
and let me just say that the TSA will often, or apologists will say, oh, but you consented to this search because you showed up at the airport. However, the most basic element of consent ought to be to know what you are consenting to. And yet the TSA refuses to describe exactly what will be touched in a pat-down. I called their helpline, and I said, will you touch me here? Will you touch me there? And they said, well, you know, we can't really say. And I said, well, are you going to tell me before you do it? They said, well, go to the airport, and then they will tell you just as before they touch that body part whether they're going to touch it or not. And I said, yes, and if I refuse? They said, oh, you can't refuse. Once you get in line, you've consented, although they don't tell you what you're consenting to.
Well, isn't that sort of like having to obey a law that you don't know what it is?
Absolutely.
Secret laws? But I don't want to just belabor the downside of things. We are making some progress. Activists like yourself are making progress. Summer, Ms. Gentry, give us some good news.
Well, one bit of good news is that the TSA is removing Rapiscan scanners from all airports. These are the blue-walled scanners that did not have any privacy filter on them, and these are also the only scanners that the TSA was using that actually have X-ray ionizing carcinogenic radiation. And so these scanners are very bad, and we're glad that they're going away. The reason that the TSA is taking them out is that Congress actually required TSA, in a rare show of force against the TSA's abuses, the Congress required the TSA to install privacy filters on all of its scanners by June 2013. That was already a one-year extension from the original deadline date. And even with that extension, the company that makes those scanners, Rapiscan, the company that Michael Chertoff is a spokesperson for, by the way.
Thank goodness he was able to profit.
Was unable to put in any privacy filtering software. So it's important for people to know that right now in airports, if they're going through those blue-walled scanners, there is a person in the back room looking at their naked body. it is not the case that all the scanners have privacy filters, but by June 2013, it will be true that all of the scanners have privacy filters.
And now, Ms. Gentry, isn't it also true that they told us from the beginning that no one would be able to see your naked body using these scanners?
They made various claims along the way that, oh, it's just a chalky outline, it's perfectly acceptable for anyone to view, except that they would never release the full resolution images. And they had that incident where the TSA screener attacked someone else that he worked with because he was being tormented over what that person had seen in the scanner. Small genitals, I guess.
Mm-hmm. And let's see, I think it was also true that, in addition to that, they said, oh yeah, right, that these are perfectly safe. Isn't it true that these things were never tested for safety?
They were never tested for safety, and the government's own panel already looked at the risk of very low doses of ionizing radiation, and they said there is absolutely no reason to believe that there is a dose level below which the risk of tumor induction is zero. That is, they said, there's no safe dose. There is no safe dose of ionizing X-ray radiation. It's all carcinogenic, and lower doses may mean fewer cases of cancer, but radiating people unnecessarily makes no sense. It should never have been done in this country.
Now, we have a very educated audience, but just in case people have forgotten, I'm going to go ahead and read the Fourth Amendment, and you can see how maybe it applies in this situation. The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizure shall not be violated, and no warrant shall issue but upon probable cause supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized. You know, it seems to me we've had an awful lot of unconstitutional government in the last few years.
I can't agree with you more, but I don't understand how people aren't viewing everything the TSA does as unconstitutional and, frankly, an outrage. I mean, they literally are treating us as guilty until we prove that we are innocent. Just because you bought a plane ticket, you become a terrorist suspect.
I was actually traveling to Washington, D.C. for an ACLU conference one time a few years back. I happened to sit next to a Supreme Court Justice of Florida, and she mentioned that the preceding year, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of Florida was actually removed from a plane because he was on the no-fly list.
Wow.
And she said when he tried to find out how his name got on the no-fly list, he wasn't able to do that. So we've got secret laws, we've got unquestionable authority, we've got clearly obvious violations. It seems to me that there's an awful lot of missing indignation out there, a lot of missing attention to these absolute abuses of the Constitution. But you have some good news. We could use some good news about now.
Well, the no-fly list suit is going forward also. There's a student who was at Stanford, who's a native of Malaysia, I think, and she was barred from coming back to the country because she was on the no-fly list. She sued, and the TSA tried very, very hard to get her suit thrown out, but they were unsuccessful, and so that battle will move forward. It's been very slow, but the no-fly list is absolutely an outrage because there is no way to challenge your placement on the no-fly list, and yet you are being deprived of your right to travel. And there are existing precedents that say that the right to travel is part of the liberty of which you cannot be deprived without due process, which means if you're on the no-fly list, you must be able to see the evidence against you and understand and be able to challenge the government's placement of you on that list. That list makes no sense. If they have information that you are plotting a terrorist attack, they should arrest you, question you, investigate you. not just not let you fly, but let you drive your car from place to place. That's absurd, right? On its face.
At best.
If they have evidence against someone, they should arrest them. But the no-fly list is in fact made up of people against whom there isn't enough evidence to investigate them. So who exactly is on this list?
Well,
people who aren't guilty enough to be charged, but apparently they're guilty enough to not fly.
Evidently, former Senator Kennedy was guilty enough of something. Maybe getting somebody's nose out of joint.
Right, but it's encouraging that a few of these court cases they've been at least willing to hear the issues involved in these. And, you know, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled, I think, a year and a half ago, it was July 2011, that the TSA had to conduct a public notice and comment period on the scanners. We're still waiting. And the court actually did order them to comply. The TSA has to run its public notice and comment period by March of this year. So we'll see whether they continue to thumb their noses at that court as they have at Congress and at the people of the United States.
Is there any other good news you've got for us today? An uphill battle, I'm afraid.
Well, you know, we have our Alaskan Freedom to Fly group that is protesting every single week in the Anchorage airport, and they get a lot of support. They post every week on our Facebook page, and they say people are happy to take our stickers. They stop and they talk about the outrages that the TSA has imposed on them, and it's great. So I actually think a lot of people are on our side, but I think people feel that it's hopeless. But it's not. We just need to be louder and insistent and persistent. And I think it's possible through public pressure to change the way the TSA operates and make them respect us as people and not treat our bodies like things to be manipulated any way they choose.
And it's obvious to anyone going through the insult line.
The gauntlet of sexual harassment, you mean?
There we go. To not appreciate the fact that these are clearly almost minimum wage jobs, and that the qualifications for someone to run their fingers over your body, poke you, prod you, there seem to be no real standards. There's clearly not security experts. And there's countless studies and examples where people have smuggled guns and weapons and equipment through that insult gauntlet. I have to ask, do you think that we are seeing the gradual eclipse of the Bill of Rights?
I hope that we are in an ebb and flow. And right now, We seem to have lost a lot of the freedoms that we should have been guaranteed. But these things may move in cycles, and I think that we all need to be fighting back, especially as it becomes more obvious that terrorism is not a big threat in our lives. Your odds of being involved in a terrorist incident in the United States are so outrageously low that we really shouldn't be worrying about it. I mean, you should have much more worry while getting on a ladder in your own house. You're more likely to be killed by your own furniture than by a terrorist.
Well,
so
you know,
the hysteria and the, well, we have to give up our rights, really doesn't add up.
Yep. We fought Germany and Japan and their allies, didn't have to lose all our rights. We had a Cold War and intermittently threats of a hot war with the Soviet Union. We never gave up our rights. Seems odd that for a few hundred odd terrorists who were basically living in a pretty difficult desert environment, that they would threaten our government and our lives so much that our government had to take these extraordinary procedures. It really seems to not quite pass the good sense test. And I want to thank you for all the very good work that you do and your colleagues. Why don't you tell our audience how to get in touch with you through your group and your website? Where can they find out information? Where will we send them?
Well, we're blogging at tsanewsblog.com. There are articles there every day. You can comment, get in touch with us that way. And so if you get on there, we will point you to the activist organizations. You know, keep writing letters to your congresspeople. They really are making a difference. And we're hoping to see Congress take some more action and make some more concrete rules for the way TSA is going to operate, because the TSA is actually endangering people by making airport screening such a disgusting experience. They are diverting people onto the roads, and more people die in car accidents who should have been taking the safest mode of transportation available, which is the airplane.
Well, thank you again so much, and keep up the good fight. We sure appreciate it. Thank you, Summer.
Thank you, Rick.
Bye-bye.
The guards or the troops were battle dressed. The poor mothers in their nudity, the fashionable. I know we're all fed up with useless wars and racial strife. The next time there's a riot, well, you best stay out of sight with that.